look at our choices. If you're a citizen, you can be denoted an enemy combatant. If you're a non-citizen, you can be executed in a military tribunal.
Well, okay, you get fired at from a crowd. How do you deal with that crowd? There's one bad apple with a gun. Do you shoot at the entire crowd?
Reports show in Colombia, since 1990 to present, over 1,900 trade unionists have been assassinated. More have had attempts on their lives, received death threats, were kidnapped or displaced.
We need this coalescence of environmental groups, peace groups, anti-globalization groups, and justice people to come together and realize that without working for justice, we cannot solve this addiction we have to war.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Thursday, May 1st, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. Standing on the deck of an aircraft carrier steaming a crew of American troops back home, President-elect Bush tonight will announce the end of the military phase of the invasion of Iraq. According to the Associated Press, Bush wants to call the invasion a success and give Americans some sense of finality now that warplanes are no longer dropping bombs on Baghdad. But White House spokesman Ari Fleischer says the President-elect will carefully parse his words so that he does not actually either declare victory or an end to war. Doing so would require the speedy release of prisoners of war and designate the U.S. as an occupying power. Bush rehearsed his address last night in the White House Theater, an indication of the importance of the speech. Tonight's carefully staged event will air at 9 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time, with 5,000 U.S. Marines and sailors providing a backdrop. It's unlikely the president will mention the growing anti-American demonstrations throughout Iraq, which have led to the shooting deaths of unarmed Iraqis, including some children. Reuters News is reporting that anti-U.S. sentiment in Iraq is rising. On Monday, U.S. troops fired on crowds of Iraqis protesting the U.S. occupation of an elementary school in Fallujah, killing between 13 and 17 civilians and wounding 70 others. Last night, demonstrators angry about the shooting Monday were fired on again by U.S. troops, killing 3 and wounding 8. Amnesty International is calling for an investigation of the killing of civilians, stating that U.S. and U.K. forces, as the occupying forces, are under an obligation to implement human rights and humanitarian laws in the areas under their control. Philip Smucker, a veteran war correspondent who writes for the Daily Telegraph and the Christian Science Monitor, was expelled from Iraq by U.S. forces at gunpoint early last month for releasing sensitive materials regarding the location of U.S. troops in the region. But Smucker says the material in question was already a matter of public record. A few days after his expulsion, Smucker returned to Baghdad with another Marine unit. 3 days ago, he left Baghdad for Cairo, Egypt, where we reached him earlier today. Peace Watch spoke with him regarding the latest shootings in Fallujah and his experiences as a unilateral journalist in Iraq.
We were driving out, and we had a run-in with some very serious gunmen in the first town we got to, and we were robbed, driven out into the desert, forced into their car, and it was rather disturbing and almost life-threatening. There's a lot of lawlessness now, but most of the lawlessness is looting and relatively nonviolent. But we ran into some pretty nasty thugs, and they were operating with a new Nissan car and a satellite phone. So maybe they saw us driving down the road and noticed that there was probably a journalist in the car. I was coming out with a car I bought in Kuwait City, and we were on the road to Amman, Jordan. And they may have pegged us from a certain point coming out of Baghdad and then phoned ahead. And then they came out and swerved in front of us a couple times, flashed their guns, and a guy came over and got us out of the car, said they were going to check us for stolen antiquities, which was a line that I bought immediately. Then we were driven into the desert and basically forced to kneel down and give up our money. And fortunately, that was all they wanted. They didn't even take my computer, which was nice of them. And then after about 15 minutes, rather harrowing experience. We were on our way in the direction of Amman.
Do you think they were in any way politically motivated by their actions?
Well, I think a lot of bitterness exists, particularly among those who were close to Saddam Hussein and his regime. It was a regime that favored those people, that small percentage that held power, and now they've been forced out. These folks could have been government because they were driving in a silver Nissan, which is a standard government issue. But it's not clear. Certainly, there's a lot of resentment about what's happened. And I think people are trying to get back at the Americans. But I'm not sure that I was necessarily targeted for being an American. I think it was more that they saw somebody in a car who had money. And the road is not well patrolled, even though it's the main highway from Baghdad to Amman. We ran into some U.S. troops about 2 hours down the road, and they're the only ones we saw on this five-hour stretch of road. And when we got to the end of the road, we heard from the Iraqi policemen who've been hired back on that there have been robberies up and down the highway all the last couple of weeks.
The U.S. troops seem to be getting antsy in terms of the duration of their stay there, the longer they stay. We are hearing reports, in fact, where increasing reports of U.S. troops shooting unarmed civilians, children in many instances, and reports tend to differ as to whether the troops have actually been fired upon or not. Of course, the latest report states that the rocket-launched grenades were fired over the wall at the troops in Fallujah. There were no reports of injuries. Have you been following those incidents? Were you anywhere near Fallujah
right when
that happened?
Well, I understand now that there are a number of injured from those grenade attacks, but I suspect some people had been shooting, and the rules of engagement are pretty strict. I think what they're trying to do is set a standard. If you shoot at us, we're going to shoot back at you. But this is a very delicate moment. You know, the Israelis, who are accused of brutalities all the time, don't often shoot into crowds and kill people. And, you know, they do, but they don't usually kill 15 as the American troops did the other day. So it's going to be a crucial phase we're going to see the next 2 or 3 weeks. You're going to have demonstrations, you're going to have responses, and the Marines certainly were not trained in peacekeeping. Now, the Army is trained, and whether or not they're going to keep the same rules of engagement or try to step down a bit in terms of the very strictest rules of engagement and operate in crowd control, use some policing tactics, which they often disdain, but may be necessary in Iraq.
Well, can you help us sort of get a picture of what it's like there for the troops? You were there. You have had an experience, a personal experience, of dealing with this level of lawlessness that is prevailing there. And as you said, the Marines have not been actually trained in peacekeeping tactics. What is it like for the troops to try and maintain some sense of law and order there?
Well, they'll tell you that. I mean, but the Marines have been in some places already replaced with the Army. But when I was with the Marines, they were saying, "Look, we were not trained in peacekeeping," and you know, it's a known fact that what they're very good at is fighting wars, and
they're trained to kill.
Their game is killing. And that's what they're very good at. And it's a very difficult mix. I mean, between wanting to be well-liked and also being a tough guy. So they're in between peacekeeping and fighting. So I think you're going to see a lot of difficulties in this transition phase. And it will really reflect on what we'll see in the future. If they can deal with the crowds and if they can set standards that the Iraqis understand, that the general population understands, then they'll succeed. But if it gets into, you know, you demonstrate, you're angry, and we're going to, you know, if you throw a grenade or shoot once, we're going to fire back into the crowd, that could potentially become a very ugly situation, worse than what the Israelis have in Palestine. And so this is the real danger, the gamble of the Iraq occupation, if you will. No one doubted that this would be a quick victory. As Donald Rumsfeld said, one of the fastest invasions of a capital ever in the history of warfare. But the real crunch time is when you've got to keep the peace, and no one believes that the U.S. forces are going to be able to pull out anytime soon because there's a total vacuum. They've got to fill the shoes of a missing government, and that means as well as a police force and security. So it's a very, very difficult peacekeeping task.
You said that you believe there probably was some shooting at the troops, which may have triggered the response on the part of the U.S. soldiers.
Well, yeah, I have no doubt. I mean, they're shooting everywhere in Baghdad at night, for example. If they say they were shot at, I suspect they have the scientific ability to detect, you know, what was happening. There are not a lot of firecrackers in Iraq, you know. So if they were the big bangs coming from that side, then I suspect there were a few shots. But the question is, well, okay, you get fired at from a crowd. How do you deal with that crowd? There's one bad apple with a gun. Do you shoot at the entire crowd? The other people may have nothing to do with that man. So this is the very difficult task of crowd control.
Philip Smucker, veteran war correspondent who writes for the Daily Telegraph and Christian Science Monitor. He spoke to us from Cairo, Egypt. Today is May Day, a holiday which began in 1886 when 340,000 workers in Chicago, Milwaukee, and other cities struck to earn an 8-hour workday. Today is commemorated as International Workers' Day around the world. This May Day has been marred by violence at celebrations around the world. According to the Bloomberg News, one person was shot dead and several were injured when supporters and opponents of President Hugo Chavez clashed in downtown Caracas. The Hindu of India reports that at least 80 people are feared dead after a bus carrying a group of trade unionists to May Day celebrations plunged into a dam in South Africa early today. Police in London, Berlin, and Istanbul arrested May Day protesters as sporadic violence disrupted a carnival atmosphere in several European cities. Berlin police detained 97 people after a group of rioters threw bottles and stones at a concert. 29 officers were injured. In Istanbul, police detained about 30 protesters, Agence France-Presse reported. In London, skirmishes broke out between police and protesters outside the headquarters of Lockheed Martin Corporation, the largest U.S. military supplier. Union activists in Colombia say that the U.S. war on terrorism and the subsequent military aid funneled through Plan Colombia have intensified their own government's repression of worker organizing. Currently, 90% of all human rights violations against labor globally occur in Colombia. Today, on International Labor Day, Peace Watch correspondent Meredith DeFrancesco spoke with Fernando Velez, a participant in the AFL-CIO's solidarity program with Colombian workers.
Reports show in Colombia, since 1990 to present, over 1,900 trade unionists have been assassinated. More have had attempts on their lives, received death threats, were kidnapped or displaced. In fact, 90% of all human rights violations against labor globally occur in Colombia. Intensifying the Colombian government's repression has been the policies of international financial institutions like the World Bank and IMF, pressuring for privatization of industry and service sectors, and the operation of transnationals who have been accused of operating in Colombia not only for the low wages but for the paramilitary control exerted against unions. Coca-Cola and Drummond Mining are both being sued, accused for their connections to paramilitary murders of union leaders. Moreover, the $7.5 billion U.S.-implemented and funded so-called Plan Colombia has, under the umbrella of the War on Drugs and the War on Terrorism, given the Colombian government massive military aid, which the unions say is being used against the people. Fernando Velez with the Municipal Workers Union and also State Employees Union.
Esta ayuda militar entonces se ha encausado.
This military aid has not been used just to fight the coca growers, but of course, from the beginning, it's been used against the armed left. But it also affects greatly in the civilian population in the zones of conflict and also in the cities. I mean, people think it's in the rural areas, but in the cities, any group that is struggling for human rights and struggling against the policies of the government and militarization and these reforms, they're all made targets of this newly strengthened military, and this includes human rights leaders and union leaders.
Velez says the justifications for the repression made in Colombia parallel sentiment and actions by the Bush administration since the events of September 11th.
Con el argumento de
the argument used to accomplish all these things, these reductions in democracy, is the anti-terrorist argument. In Colombia, measures have been taken by Uribe immediately on going into office. He declared an internal state of emergency that then allowed him to reduce democratic privileges, but also do some things like create a national network of informants who would supposedly help identify those people who would be a risk for the Colombian state or government.
Colombian unions find hope in solidarity with unions beyond their borders.
Nosotros creemos que solo
so
con
we
la
think,
ayuda,
especially in the union movement, that only with international solidarity and its help will we find a way out of the conflict that the Colombian civil society and unions are in. We need the U.S. people to speak out against the permanent, constant abuse of human rights that's going on in the country, to demand that their government stop sending money that is used to repress people in Colombia, stop sending their tax dollars that are used to kill innocent people and civilians.
Amidst these conditions, the AFL-CIO Solidarity Center and others have started a program that offers Colombian unionists a year working with unions in the U.S. to share skills and draw more attention to the conditions in Colombia. Fernando had a message for those listening on International Labor Day.
Los trabajadores latinoamericanos y, en general, el movimiento de los trabajadores mundial.
So workers in Latin America, and in fact everywhere in the world, commemorate the Chicago massacre of 1886. They celebrate the 1st of May, and we have a lot of public events, public acts, workers are in the street. We think it's very important to commemorate this everywhere in the world. In all the big cities have commemorate the martyrs of Chicago who struggled and protested for better conditions.
Se sumen a esa conmemoración a nivel mundial.
U.S. North American workers will participate. It's very important that they too commemorate May 1st, go into the streets and march and struggle for those things, not just in Colombia, but here in the United States and elsewhere. I think that the struggle for human rights, May 1st, International Workers' Day, is very important.
Y de seguridad y de derechos humanos.
This is Meredith DeFrancesco.
When former Texas Governor George W. Bush left the Lone Star State and moved down the road to the White House, he tried not to look back, but as luck would have it, his past caught up with him. His pal Kenny Boy Lay and the whole Enron group were among the skeletons from his past. Now, as the Bush administration carries out its war on terrorism, he's gathered up some of his fellow Texans, like U.S. General Tommy Franks and old friends at Halliburton, to help him stay on top of his game. But opposition to Bush's policies in Iraq and on the domestic front remains vocal and visible, most notably in Texas. This weekend, Bush's home state hosts a national protest billed as the showdown in Texas. Communities of color, immigrants' rights groups, anti-war groups, and global justice proponents will all converge on the state capitol on Saturday to highlight George W. Bush's escalating policy of war and militarism in the face of increasing cuts in domestic spending and civil rights. Pacifica Station KPFT's local news shares this report from a press conference about the showdown, beginning with Houston organizer Kenyon Johnson of the American Friends Service Committee.
We will celebrate and renew our resistance to war and militarism. We will renew our resistance to the dismantling of civil rights. We will renew our resistance to the undermining of labor rights. We will renew our resistance to the persecution and deportation of immigrants. We will renew our resistance to brutality and state-sanctioned murder. We will renew our resistance to exploitation of the environment. and we will renew our resistance to all forms of oppression that divide and exploit the American people.
Also speaking in support for the showdown in Texas was Southwest Regional Pastor of the Shrine of the Black Madonna, Cardinal Aswad. Aswad says the Bush administration is creating an atmosphere of fear and suppression that has not been seen since the 1950s.
He has cut $39 million from public libraries, cut $60 million from the Boys and Girls Club of America public housing programs, pulled out of the Kyoto Protocol on global warming that 178 other countries were in agreement with, refused to participate in the World Conference on Racism, cut $500 million from the Environmental Protection Agency, rejected an international accord to enforce a treaty on banning germ warfare. So policy after policy, decision after decision, shows a total disdain for the rights of the people. And someone has to step up and speak out about it. And there's a lot of folk out there who feel outraged, but because we're living in McCarthy-like times, are afraid to speak out.
Spokesperson for Not In Our Name Houston, Raj Mankad, says that with increasing restrictions on immigration policy, the Bush administration's, quote, war on terrorism is actually helping to build coalitions between immigrant rights groups and other social justice organizations.
Because what we're seeing right now is the deportation of immigrants without due process. Another thing that's happening to immigrants now, we are facing the type of police brutality and the type of profiling, racial profiling, that black folks have been facing for years. So now we're beginning to see, you know, what it was like for black folks. And now we're starting to get active.
Come on.
But we should have been active a long time ago. We should have been working with black folks before, with Latino people. We can't wait for the government to come for us before we start speaking up.
When KPFT News asked whether the showdown in Texas would have an effect on the policymakers, SHAPE Community Center founder Deloyd Parker alluded to the 1965 Voter Rights March in Selma, Alabama.
Somebody asked that same question when they marched across the Edmund Pettus Bridge when Bloody Sunday took place. When people were beaten down and kicked and stomped on and trampled by horses and water hoses shot on them, somebody said, you think there's hundreds of people attempting to cross this bridge symbolically just to go to Montgomery is going to impact or make change or do anything, be effective? No, it didn't, in and of and by itself. But that was a turnaround Tuesday also. When we went to that bridge and we knelt down and prayed and we turned around and went back. But that was a third time when we made it across that bridge from Selma to Montgomery. And now people at least have the right to vote. This in and of itself will not do it. But the sister said it earlier. This is yet but one step. Just one step, that's all. But that step is not going to be made by one person. People all over the country are taking those same steps.
That's right.
Yes. We call it steps of unity. Steps of unity.
With buses coming from Houston and around the country, organizers expect the multi-issue rally to be among the largest and most diverse in Texas history. The showdown in Texas kicks off Saturday at 11 a.m. with five converging marches meeting in front of the state capitol building at high noon.
That piece was produced at Pacifica Station KPFT in Houston, Texas, by Renee Feltz, with assistance from narrator Farah Chomchi and reporter Jackson Allers. While President Bush prepares to make a speech tonight declaring an official end to the military action on Iraq, a diverse group, including indigenous people, African Americans, Arabs, and others, gathered today for a four-day conference at George Washington University here in the nation's capital. Addressing this conference entitled Movement Beyond Borders, Beyond Durban, U.S. Communities Building a Multiracial and Human Rights Vision, Arizona Democrat Congressional Representative Raul Grijalva underscored the link between post-September 11th America, the war on Iraq, and the effects on communities of color in this country.
The failure of this nation to be fully engaged in this world community is troubling to not only those of us that are here today, but should be troubling to the whole country and to the whole world. The perception right now that might makes right, that military power overcomes any other means of dialogue and communication and understanding amongst people, seems to be the perception people have, not only of our nation, but unfortunately it seems to be the attitude of our government. And I think the Movement Beyond Borders is an important statement. Not only is it a new vision, but it's resurrecting a very important ideal and a very important value that all peoples have. The dignity and justice and human rights are not merely commodities that we move on a chessboard, that they're very much part of the life and breath and future of this world. And I find it so ironic that our administration is an isolationist when it comes to everything else, but it's not an isolationist when it talks about the free market, commerce, trade, and as those discussions continue about what free trade agreements are going to be like, what commerce is going to be like. They embrace this global economy concept, notwithstanding that sometimes the actions of our country has had tremendous detrimental effect in the third world and the world in general, to indigenous societies, to societies whose life is dependent on land, agriculture, trade and commerce within their own history and within their own culture. We've had tremendous detrimental effect in those societies. But we continue in this globalization without thought and without putting in that human component that we're affecting. So this administration loves to talk about the global economy, but they don't like to talk about the global community that we have here. The global community that is dependent on each other. I'm here today because I think this movement and your conference is essential to begin to set a tone that the American people in the world, but let's just talk about the American people, have not forgotten their traditions just because of the might makes right ethic that we seem to find, or unethic that we seem to find in this government. Our traditions are not lost. Our traditions of peace, our traditions of human rights, our very valuable and important traditions of justice and dignity for one another and respect, those are not lost. And you are reminding and re-energizing all of us with this conference and with the movement that those are ideals and traditions and values that are as American as apple pie and as important to this world as anything else. And I just want to add my small voice to continue to join with you in turning this country's face toward the world and to present a face that is compassionate and present a face to this world that understands that if we're going to live together, we must respect each other, and if we're going to live together, we must help each other. Thank you very much.
Arizona Democratic Congressional Representative Raul Grijalva spoke at the Movement Beyond Borders, Beyond Durban conference that's taking place through Sunday here in the nation's capital. Thanks to Reem Kathuda, Peace Watch producer from Pacifica Station, to WPFW in Washington, for preparing that segment. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.